Welcome to the Portion Podcast. This is the podcast where we talk about the weekly Torah portion. I'm your host, Aaron Roller, here with my co-host, Rabbi Jonathan Bienenfeld.
And I'm thrilled, to be here.
Anything new? Anything going on?
Anything new and anything going on. I mean, Shavuos is around the corner. Lag BaOmer is really around the corner, and that's pretty exciting.
Will you be lighting any fires?
I will be lighting a number of fires in undisclosed locations. We're going to be having a bonfire at the shul. It should be a lot of fun. It always is fun every single year. And Lag BaOmer is great. It's just about the idea of rebirth and starting fresh. After Rabbi Akiva loses all of his students in a plague, thousands and thousands of students, and it all that work sort of just implodes. Not to mention the loss of actual human life, but his entire career, everything that he's done, and then there's this determination and decision to raise five new students who effectively become the leaders of the next generation. Just the perseverance, the tenacity, the ability to continue on. It's one of those great Netzach Yisrael Lo Yishaker moments of Jewish history.
It's interesting that on Lag BaOmer, the personalities of the day are two rabbis who seem to be so different in terms of their personalities. We have Rabbi Akiva, who is, you know, the V'ahavta l'recha kamocha, you know, love your neighbor, that's the great principle of the Torah, sort of seems more, kind of down to earth and optimistic. And then we also mark Lag BaOmer as the hilula or the yortzeit of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, who's like a, you know, very, kind of tough, rigorous, you know, in terms of rabbis who are sort of their personalities are supposed to be, you know, really tough. And he takes in sort of a negative, he looks at the Roman Empire and anything good that they've built, he looks at it very negatively. It's kind of interesting. We have those two perspectives going on.
I mean, it's funny that you say that. I always thought about Rabbi Akiva. I do think of him as, I don't know, perhaps more of a, just for lack of a better term, something of a people person. On the one hand, on the other hand, this is the same person who effectively locked himself in a yeshiva for 24 years without ever seeing his wife or any other family member for that matter. But he
saw his students.
Granted. I mean, and Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai was, I mean, he did, he hid in the cave and he secluded himself to a much greater degree, I suppose, apart from the rest of society. It is interesting whether there are, yes, undoubtedly certain similarities, I suppose, in both, as is the case when it comes to all Torah greats and all great personalities, all Torah personalities. But it is a remarkable thing that rabbi and student can be very different from one another and can still go on to great things, great experiences, great leadership, even if marked by different character traits.
Anyway, getting to that'll be the day this show is released. But 2 days after that, we will be reading Parshat Behar. I'm so excited to have this conversation. There's some ways in which I think that this is like a culmination of both Sefer Vayikra and also I've probably said this before, this is like a high point in the Torah, but I think there's something really remarkable going on here. In a nutshell, we get a lot of the laws of the land of Eretz Yisrael when the Israelites settle in the land that they have to observe the laws of the sabbatical laws, every 7 years letting the land lie fallow, and the jubilee year every 50 years, having also letting it lie fallow, but also that debts are forgiven and property goes back to its original owner. And from there, it talks about related laws of redeeming slaves and redeeming land. And that seems technical. It seems maybe distant from the way we live, what our day-to-day concerns, and we still have Shemitah now, but it's these agricultural laws and certainly laws involving slaves or bondsmen or basically people owning other people for work seem very distant, but I think that there's something. Last week I sort of, I think it was last week, a week or two ago, I skirted this question, like, is the Torah a capitalist book? Is the Torah a socialist book? And it's what I think, and I didn't want to talk about it then, because I said it's anachronistic, and it doesn't make any sense to talk about it in those terms. But I actually think that what is happening here, and I still think that, but also we are getting in this week's Parsha a view into, I think, a completely alternative economic system, one which is unlike anything that we see today, and I think one which is really unlike anything in most of world history. And if it were the case that the kingdom of Israel ever ran this way, I think it's really a sign of being like a light unto the nations and creating something. And the reason that I say this is because what we have here is, I'm going through this parsha and I just can't stop thinking about like how on earth does investment work? We live in a society where real estate investment seems to be, you know, there's tech, but getting into real estate is usually a pretty sound business strategy. And you know, because as they say about land, they're not making any more of it.
Who says that? Oh, it's brilliant.
Well, you know, whoever thought of it, I'm sure it was
so accurate
that they're not making any more land.
I mean, except for landfills, I guess. But yeah, basically, well,
yeah, you know, that balances against global warming and rising tides. So it all
evens out.
Net, hopefully. We should talk to some of the climate people about more landfills. This is not. This is not to discuss climate issues. We don't know what we're talking about. So I'm reading this. I'm like, how do you make a profit on real estate deal? And who would build a skyscraper? You know, you only own something. Certain things are, you know, the 99 year lease is something which operates in the modern economy.
Right,
but
I mean, you have it for a certain period of time. There just needs to be that expectation. But also, even so, and we should probably give a little bit of backdrop for this, which is that at the Yovel, right, everything reverts back to the original owner, at least for the most part, barring right. certain exceptions and walled cities, things like that. But basically, everything goes back to the original owner. And that being the case, as you're saying, it's very difficult to actually run, to really manage your investments properly. Having said that, I why do you feel that this is not just something that I suppose you sort of get used to and you plan for? I mean, with that knowledge, then leases look the way that they do, and it's rented for the appropriate time frame and also commensurate price.
I mean, listen, I'm not a great real estate investor, but I just think that if you maybe at the outset of the 50 years, you got more opportunity, perhaps, you know, and the lifespans being what they are, you know, I don't know how long people are living, but like your prospects of saying like, I'm going to invest X amount and, you know, it's worth it to me to develop this and to develop that, when in fact I know that, you know, any improvements that I put on a property are going to, it could be 50 years, but certainly no more than that, are going to revert back to somebody else.
Unless it's yours in the first place.
No, that's true. That's true. You can develop your own ancestral
but,
land.
But perhaps that's the idea, meaning to say that is exactly what the Torah is trying to drive us all towards, meaning developing the property that is yours, that is your ancestral heritage, but not to come onto somebody else's property or not to be, you know, serve as sort of a speculator when it comes to somebody else's land.
That's exactly where I was going with this. Exactly.
Oh, gosh,
that.
I'm really sorry. I think that was
perfectly...
Steal your thunder. Can we edit this out?
That's it. I'm done. No, exactly that. That the basis for this, is truly... It's truly divine. It goes past our time frame of the five books of Moses into Sefer Yehoshua, the first book of the prophets, the book of Joshua, where the land is actually divided. But that's the thing, that every family, every tribe, and every family within the tribe gets ancestral land, and that land, barring a Babylonian exile or an Assyrian diaspora, it remains with that family unit in perpetuity. And that's so different, that the idea that everybody in the society has their ancestral land. You know, nationalism gets a bad rap, and that's a complicated conversation, but the idea that, you know, the question of, you know, blood and soil, like, you know, you learn about this stuff in history class, but this is really, really tying people to a land in a way that I don't think, you know, it exists in a more abstract sense in other countries. We've been here for thousands of years. My ancestors have been here. But the idea that, like, we can't get rid of this land if we want to, I think that's very unique. And exactly that, the idea that it militates against speculation, It militates against, you know, massive consolidations of land, and I think it militates against massive income inequality. So it doesn't negate a capitalist system. People are, you know, entitled to own and to buy and to sell and to be enterprising.
It's capitalism with borders.
Very much so. And I think it's a, and but it only works, right? I mean, I believe in free enterprise. I believe that, you know, capitalism is has been the engine for the greatest human prosperity, but it also leads to abuses and inequalities. And whenever it's curtailed, it leads to, you know, people's rights being abrogated. But in this case, the reason that it works, these borders that you mentioned, is because it's based on brotherhood. The idea, maybe people listen think I do get very political in subtext, but I don't usually talk about politics directly, but I'm going to, Rabbi Bienenfeld, so, you know, forgive me for going off, but
I'll be back in 5 minutes.
There you go. But no, I think that a big part of the challenge, you know, without weighing in on who or why or what's at fault, in American society today, and this probably is not news even to our international listeners, is we are dealing with a sense of polarization, a sense of disunity that, you know, my lifetime is certainly not that long in comparison to the rest of American history, but it's not what it was when I was a kid. And however else you want to slice it, I think that there's a feeling, there's a lack of feeling of brotherhood. There's a lack of feeling that we are all in it together, that we all share values, that we all share a culture, or that the culture that we share is worth sharing. I mean, this in sharp contrast, what we get, what I found so beautiful and so inspiring in this week's Torah portion is an alternative political economic framework where God is at the center and brotherhood is at the center. I mean, this idea that, you know, we talk about the, you know, the people are tied to the God and the land is tied to the people and the Torah is at the center of it all. I mean, that's why I call it a climax or a culmination, because we get a vision of a kind of society that can only function when the concept of Kedusha, the concept of holiness, the concept of a transcendent reality, which binds us to each other and gives us responsibilities towards one another, only when that is manifest could this possibly work. And we know that, historically speaking, ultimately it didn't work, although we have faith that it will ultimately. But that's a very, very inspiring vision.
Yeah, I think it's a really important point that you need all of those different elements in order to make it work. Meaning, first and foremost, the idea that this is actually mandated by God, right? That means that the idea of maintaining the kinds of rules and regulations about real estate and about property value and property ownership, all these things are actually bound up with religion and no different in a way, no different than dietary laws, kashrus, Shabbos, family purity, all those kinds of things, meaning the sort of things that any religious Jew is going to take very, very seriously and stand at the core of what his religious expression is, these laws are no different. So abiding by them is going to carry the same weight. And I think that, and indeed this should be the case, that as society progresses, one of the things that we do almost automatically is we consider all the ideas, all of the efforts of the previous generations and the previous time periods, and we wonder and we analyze and we scrutinize and we raise issues and we raise flaws and we take note of the fact that maybe it's not as perfect or as ideal as it could be or should be, and let's perfect it and let's tinker with it. And I think that when you have God at the center of it and you believe in something as being actually divinely mandated, it doesn't really accord you that ability. Look, which is why, to no small degree, as much as Jews recognize that there are changing times and changing personalities and changing, there's a changing consciousness that has to be addressed on the one hand. On the other hand, we often dig in and try to buck the current trends because it's more of an adherence to whatever the divine word is than a function of trying to almost figure out every system on my own, whether it's political or economic or whatever, that there's a sense that we have been walking around with a divine mandate for however long and we want to adhere to that. So unfortunately, we don't have the opportunity to observe these laws, at least certainly not fully in the present day, but there's the hope and the expectation, the anticipation that we're going to be able to do so to do so very soon. I think one thing that's very interesting, and again, in light of saying that and believing and knowing that this is divine will, so it's not something that I'm really questioning, just something that I was sort of throwing out there. I think what's interesting about this, you know, you were speaking about how just a short while ago, like when we were kids, and I remember it also, there seemed to be much more of a sense of fluidity between political parties and sharing sort of common values and not allowing some of the rhetoric that we find now to build these to become so deeply entrenched that it creates these really divisive kinds of walls between Americans. There's just but I still think it exists, that there's this sense of like, I'm an American, I believe in certain things, and I believe in the kinds of things that all other Americans believe in. And what I think is interesting, having learned about what life was like in this country, certainly in revolutionary times and then shortly thereafter, is that the whole concept of feeling, you know, I don't know that I've ever really felt, there's a certain measure of pride just because of, especially growing up, just because of all the landmarks and because it's the largest city and the greatest city on earth. But I don't know how much pride there really is in saying that I'm from New York or I'm from New Jersey. Or I'm from Delaware.
Well, definitely not New Jersey. No, joking.
Ouch.
We love New Jersey.
We love New Jersey.
Especially South Jersey.
We love New Jersey because it's so easy to get to New York from here. So easy to get to Delaware from New Jersey. You know, I don't know how much that really exists. To some degree, I'm a Southerner, or I'm a Midwesterner, or I'm city, I'm country. But for the most part, like, Americans are Americans. And I think a lot of that is true, especially nowadays, that both by design, because there's one shared currency and because there are interstate highways and it's so easy to travel from point A to point B. But there are also just certain ubiquitous American landmarks, if you will, that apply and exist and crop up in every locale and in every society. I remember moving to New Jersey from, you know, I lived in New York, grew up in New York, moved to Ohio, moved back to New Jersey. And there's something very comforting, almost as much as we all sort of bemoan the loss of the mom and pop shops. There's something very comforting about moving to Ohio, which is a number of states away. And it's whatever it was like an 11-hour drive from where I was. And it's the same Home Depot and it's the same Target. And you basically know the aisles and the blueprint, you know, by heart. Now, you could argue that there's a lot less character. Indeed, that's true. But there's something comforting about seeing some of the same things over and over and over again. And I just think that one item that's interesting here is that as much as there is an absolute tie to this particular parcel of land, the other thing that it does is it may give rise to a certain sense of belonging and ownership when it comes to not only this land, but belonging to the family, the familial plot that's all around me, and then also the shavehead, also the sense of this is my tribal community. And that, it is what it is. That can very easily give rise to this sense of Jew versus Jew. That, you know, I'm from Yehuda. Yehuda is the best tribe there is. What are you talking about, Yehuda? We know you guys are all a bunch of, you know, uppity whatever. And we're from Naphtali. We're the real salt of the earth. And Naphtali, give me a break. You know, we're Reuven, and we're on the, you know, we live on the other side of the Jordan, where it's much more beautiful and it's much more scenic. And we're like the outdoorsmen and the frontiersmen. I just think that is bound to happen. There is something very beautiful and very important about that, feeling a sense of pride of Shevet, something that is completely lost on us at this stage in Jewish history, on the one hand. On the other hand, there is trouble there. There is potential trouble there if it's not kept in check.
Is that so? To change the subject completely, do you think that that's one of the roles that sports plays in modern life? It gives a more appropriate channel for regional pride and differences.
Do you mean like this is the roles and this is why God put sports here, or this is why people love sports?
It's why society developed sports. Maybe.
I think society developed sports because we have an affinity for and a fascination with human ability at its peak,
and also playing with balls.
That is the other thing that we love.
I don't even say that as a joke. I'm just saying, like, you know,
pucks.
I have kids, and you know, really, from as soon as they're old enough to hold one, you know, a ball is fun.
If you lived north of the border, it would be a puck.
Yeah. Although they play ball there too. Anyway,
yeah.
They just Raptors just took out Philadelphia.
That's true. That's true. I was thinking about baseball and
too,
you know how
too soon. Too you soon. Know, yeah. But anyway, to get back to the top. So I wonder about the I think regional differences are kind of healthy, and I think we have them in the U.S. I mean, it's there's been sociological studies on voting patterns and on, you know, just in terms of like voting attitudes towards gun control. I read this very interesting article about an academic who traced migration patterns. You know, the bulk of Americans in different regions came from different countries in Europe and elsewhere, and that those migration patterns, you know, he tried to claim led to all kinds of attitudes. So that even if people on the West Coast are voting Democrat and people in the Northeast are voting Democratic, there's different nuances in terms of what people are passionate about and why they vote Democratic, you know, or in, you know, anyway, it doesn't matter. The point is that we've got a vision here, and God is at the center of it here. In this week's hopefully in the U.S., but not an argument.
I just want to reflect on that one more time. I love the idea that Torah has, not that God needs my approbation, but that Torah has a political system in mind. It has an economic system in mind. The idea that these items are considered to be no less holy because they're a part of life. They can be sanctified no differently from the way that we would put on tefillin, or that we would observe a holiday, or that we would only put certain foods into our mouths. The sense that the way that I conduct business and the way that I purchase a plot of land and all of that is mandated and regulated by Torah, I think, is just so speaks to the ability to draw sanctity and imbue sanctity into every dimension of life.
And I was going to say that there are some places in the Torah, but it's rare when a specific reward is mentioned, or more to the point, I guess in this case, a specific supernatural, you know, miraculous occurrence takes place. And yet, speaking to the idea that God is at the center of it all, with the idea of the Shemitah year, the sabbatical year, that God is saying, it says, you know, quite clearly in chapter 25, verse 20, if you will say, what will we eat in the seventh year? Behold, we will not sow and we will not gather our crop. This is God speaking, I will ordain my blessing for you in the sixth year, and it will yield a crop sufficient for 3 years. So you'll get, in the sixth year, you'll get your crops from the sixth year. You'll get crops to last you through the seventh year, and crops to last you while your plants are growing in the eighth year. And that's God just saying, like, yeah, I'll make a miracle for you once every 7 years. It's staggering, I think, in terms of a true. There's something also I would sort of combine this with something very very pastoral. The idea of the people are going back to the land, and you're, you know, back with your family and this tribal background that we're talking about, and it's all. And maybe this is actually less than sports. It's God that is the thing which militates against these tribal differences, not because saying one tribe is better than the other or one tribe is all equal, but rather what the sabbatical year and the Jubilee year tell the people is that they don't actually own the land. The fact that you have to let the land rest every 7 years, and it should go without saying, but obviously this is an aspect of Shabbos, right? If Shabbos, every 7 days we rest and it's taking a break in time. Well, I guess this is time also.
It's also a break in, right.
But it's agricultural based, that the land itself gets a Shabbos. And the Jubilee, that really everything resets, is just, I mean, it says it explicitly, that God is saying, I am in control. I am the one who owns the land. I am the one who is able to distribute it as I saw fit to the different tribes. It was distributed according to their size and to what was going to be appropriate for them, and so that should probably reduce any sense of, you know, on the one hand you're connected to the land, on the other hand you have to recognize that you are not the ultimate master of that land as well. So hopefully that you know, that would imbue a certain sense of humility.
So I want to agree with you unequivocally on the one hand, but also as is the case for really everything in the Torah. You know, we say that Shivim Panim LaTorah, there are 70 different facets or dimensions to Torah, could be turned this way and that way. Sometimes even conflicting, almost conflicting interpretations can all be latent within the same concept. I think that is so typically the way that we think about Shabbos and the way that we typically think about the idea of Shemitah, the sabbatical year. I just want to share I don't know if I've ever mentioned this to you before. Rabbi Shamshon Raphael Hirsch has
definitely mentioned this Rabbi Shamshon Raphael Hirsch
here on this podcast
to me before.
But I don't know if I've ever mentioned this particular idea. He has such a beautiful. I think it is so important and so empowering, really, for our generation. What he says is that what we're doing on Shabbos, and it can, I think, be equally applied to the land and the sabbatical year of the land. What we're really trying to do when it comes to Shabbos is actually mimicking exactly what God did, right? So God is engaged in the creation of the world for 6 days, and then he rests on the seventh day. We're mimicking that. Why is that valuable? Why is that important? Because what God effectively is showing by stepping back is that I really do own this place, is that it is that I am the master, I am in control of my work, and not the other way around. Meaning sometimes we can become so wrapped up in our work, in our labor, our avoda, that it becomes almost compulsive. Like, I can't put it down. I can't leave my inbox where it is. I have to answer that next email. It's 1 o'clock in the morning. It makes no difference. It'll still be there tomorrow. I really could use the sleep, but I almost can't just leave it where it is because there's always more to do and there's always more to tinker. And it becomes just this compulsive act of, let me just check my phone another few times to see what else I can do. Let me fill every spare minute.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Certainly not, but I'm sure you have friends who are.
That's right.
So Rabbi Hirsch says that that's what God was doing. That's what we do. Meaning in order to show that it is we who are in control of our work and of our labor and what we produce, we need to step away. And maybe that's exactly what's going on here with the Shemitah in some very real dimension, in order to show that yes, absolutely, we are bowing in deference to God's sovereignty. God, you really run the place. But perhaps on some level to say that our relationship with the land needs to be a healthy one. It needs to be something that we're able to walk away from and to be able to properly appreciate, properly just maintain a proper relationship instead of getting into this place where compulsively we're forced to constantly work. It's that we own the land as opposed to the land owning us.
I love this idea. I think there's so many aspects to that lesson, right? I mean, ultimately,
you got to put down the ducky if you want to play the saxophone.
Deep cut. yeah, but
you own the ducky, or does the ducky own you?
Wow, I don't know. Sometimes I don't know where the stuff is coming from.
Do you really not know that?
No, I know where the stuff is coming from in Sesame Street. I don't know how that's where your mind went.
My mind is always there. My mind is always with Ernie and what's his name? Mr. Hoots?
That's right. So yeah. Support your local public television and public radio owl station. The idea that like true control is learning to let go, right? You know that it's that's what it is. You know, or if you love something, set it free. Like that's what it is. And I think that's great. I think it's
another great Rav Hirsch line, by the way. He says that the educator is the one whose role it is to make himself superfluous.
Absolutely.
And that's such a struggle, right? We would love to have our students, children, whatever, just like eating out of our hands for the rest of their lives on one level. It makes us feel powerful and needed and wanted, and to know that you've raised a child or a student who's now self-sufficient and doesn't need you in the same sort of way, chisels away at the ego a little bit, but it's everything. It's everything that we do.
All right. So I want to raise something which might be a philosophical minefield, but something that has been on my mind that relates to this. So this was not planned, I've been thinking a lot about the question about, you know, do we have an obligation to believe in God, or do we have to know God, and is it possible to know that God exists? And I know that I think there are different streams or different interpretations of what knowledge means, what belief means, but for myself, what I've been thinking about is that, like, I don't think God wants or expects us to know him the way that we, you know that our hand is in front of us, the way that we experience the material world. And I think that's why God isn't, one reason why God is not in the material world. And the reason that I think this is, like, that, you know, how do you know that your spouse has been faithful to you? You don't really, right? I mean, you go into a marriage with, you know, the best expectations, with love, with trust, with faithfulness. And you believe that your partner goes into it with that also, but then you never know. And if you wanted to truly know, and there's all kinds of, you know, folk tales and Arabian Night stories about, you know, viziers and kings who have this feeling, but if you really wanted to know, you would have to shackle somebody to a wall. You would have to take away their freedom. And that wouldn't be love at all. It would kill the love. And I've been thinking about sort of how that relates to our relationship with God, that God, that in order to, for us to truly express our love in a free way, that God has to be not, you know, that if we could see God every, wherever we went in the same way we see, you know, oncoming traffic, you know, if you turn, make a wrong turn, you know, you,
but
you
is lost. You wouldn't be free will to, is lost.
You would be shackled in a way that sort of, I think, defeats the purpose of creation. So, you know, God, so to speak, in this way, and I think this gets back to this beautiful point you bring up from Rav Hirsch, the way I'm thinking about it, and there might be other ways of thinking about what knowledge means, what Da'at means, but God, essentially, we are that for God, that God, just as God steps away to show that he's master of the world, you know, part of the delicate interplay between the creator and creation is for him to step away from us to allow us to truly develop a relationship, a worship, a love for him. It's like I said, it's a philosophical minefield, but it resonated. It's something that's been on my mind that I've been kind of toying with and thinking through. And that's just sort of the metaphor that has been resonating with me. And I'm sure that could take us in many, many different directions, but I wanted to kind of lay that out for you.
Love it.
Well, thank you. Well, it probably warrants more conversation, but just to get back to one point, and I think we struggled. We talked about the morality of slavery way back in Parshat Mishpatim. You can go listen to that episode if you haven't. But this week talks about, and I think it's just like it's part and parcel with the land, you know, this vision of the land is, and this idea that we talked about of, that the whole society is based on a feeling of love and brotherhood between people, between the Jewish people, really. That you have to, that the only way the society works is if people view each other as being bound to one another in this mission, in this recognition that God is the master, that God gave them this land. And part and parcel with that is redeeming of slaves. You know, in a society where human beings can be bought and sold, and that could be for a person sells themselves into servitude because they have fallen on bad times, or a person stole and can't repay. There are different scenarios where this is the case, but the idea that, like, it can't be acceptable to you. It's not just, okay, oh, he got himself into trouble, we're going to let him serve his time, but rather that, you know, there are the verses in this week's Parsha that say, it's your brother. You have to, you know, if he has fallen into slavery, you should try to pay the person who bought him, pay him off, or help him so it doesn't fall into these times. Like, there's a vision here, which is a vision of national unity and responsibility for yourself, but also for one another, and a feeling that, you know, every 7 years the slaves go free, and so you can't, again, sort of those things which weigh against massive inequality and massive polarization. And I think that, and I referenced this earlier, the idea of being a light unto the nations. In various conversations I've had, there's this question about, like, well, why doesn't that apply to everybody? You know, how come it says in contrast to your brother that, you know, another slave you can keep forever, you can keep their children forever? I don't think it's that. Firstly, I don't think it's justifying slavery as an institution. What I actually think it's doing is saying, like, those people should take care of their people too. Like, they should learn from what you do. I mean, maybe it's a stretch, or maybe it's an apologetic, but I really got that sense reading the Parsha this year, that it's saying, like, you've got to treat everybody like your brother when they're your brother. And it's not saying don't be, listen, you can, you know, I think by and large we've left slavery and we don't think it's a good idea. But the point is that, like, this is a vision of seeing your nation as, everyone in your nation is indispensable, that really, I think, is trying to set a tone for the larger world. That's how I took it this year, in a way that it bothered me less than it maybe did in other years. I don't know what your, if you.
Well, I was going to leave that thought and actually look at, I think, just as you were speaking, one of the other things that I thought about when it comes to this need to, like, redeem your brother, your relative, to serve as a redeemer for this slave. I'm just tying this back to the idea that we were talking about at the very beginning of the show, with the Jubilee year, sort of giving everybody, making sure that all the land goes back, meaning that apart from all the other factionalization, what this does for the person, I just imagine this, you know, this great real estate magnate who is, you know, doing the equivalent of flying all over the land of Israel. And he's got this whole real estate empire, and he has holdings here, there, and everywhere. And he's just not to be found. He's not to be found by his family. He's not to be found amongst his brothers. He's completely disconnected, and he's lost touch. And one of the things that ensuring that your land is your heritage, and that this is what you really cling to, and whatever other investments you know are going to be short term, you sort of know where your headquarters is, and that brings you into contact with the people around you and your family. It means you're having these close relationships with your family members, so that when your brother, when your cousin, when your whomever falls on hard times, you're not off in isolation, kind of living your own life, doing your own thing, disconnected from those that you grew up with, so that you're there to serve as this redeemer and help him when he actually needs a hand.
I think that's, you know, and again, reflecting back to modern society, I mean, I think that's, you know, books have been written about this as well. You know, Charles Putnam, I think, and Charles Murray, sociologists talking about the change in society where CEOs, you know, the amount that CEOs make, you know, the highest paid employee compared to the lowest paid employee is just skyrocketed.
Sure.
And that's followed it's followed things going multinational, and it's followed also the wealthiest people living in gated communities and not coming in. You know, it's followed the pattern of those bosses not having to look those people in the eye.
Right.
And that's so I think that's it's really very resonant. Well, with that vision in mind, we're going to wrap it up. Hopefully, I think this I've really enjoyed the
conversation.
This is
a great one.
And next week we will finish the book. I'm looking forward to it. The Portion Podcast is recorded in Cherry Hill, produced by Aaron Roller. Our theme music is The Magid's Niggin by Simply Tzvot. If you enjoy the show, please tell your friends about it any way you can. You can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. Don't forget to rate us and leave a review. And you can follow the show on Facebook. Have a good Shabbos, and remember, there is always more to learn.